to the History of Little Europe. Episode 1.22, the Switzerland Grand Finale. Well, we're finally here. It's been quite the journey, but I want to thank each and every one of you for coming along with me. If I'm being honest, I didn't think we would get this far. I have two objectives to cover for this episode. The first is to do a quick run-through of the major events in Switzerland between the end of the Second World War and the modern day. After that, I want to wrap up the show with some concluding thoughts as to what all of this means. So, if you skipped any of the episodes up to this point, now is a great time to go back and listen to them. Hint, hint. With that out of the way, let's get right to it. Following the conclusion of World War II, Switzerland found itself in much the same position as it was following the first, in that, unlike much of Europe, its industry and population base was still intact. And, now that workers enjoyed far more rights than their neighbors, the industrial base was also far more productive per capita. The result was an unprecedented 30 years from 1945 to 1975, during which the country enjoyed nearly continuous economic growth. In fact, the country quickly reached the odd position of having too many jobs for not enough workers, which further gave working-class citizens leverage over their wages. When such a situation arises, it is, of course, natural that the nation turns to immigration. Over the course of the 20th century, Switzerland accepted millions of immigrants, mostly from Mediterranean nations like Portugal, Spain, and of course, Italy. As often happens, this was met with an equal rise in xenophobia, but the state has not yet succumbed to such populist tides and remains open to immigration to this day, although most now comes from the Balkan regions. Alongside this economic boom came a resulting expansion in infrastructure. Building on their already strong network, the Swiss undertook a series of programs to expand the rail system over the coming decades, including the construction of a series of new tunnels crossing the Alps. Today, the network ranks among the best in the world in terms of time of travel and quality, even in comparison to nations like Japan, who, unlike Switzerland, use high-speed bullet trains. To correspond with these new rail networks came the establishment of a new highway system, mostly focused on linking major cities. In 1964, Switzerland constructed the St. Bernard Tunnel, the first automobile tunnel to cross the Alps. The state also took time to rapidly expand its energy sectors, including the construction of various new dam projects across the country, as well as expanding into this newfound nuclear energy that everyone seems to be talking about. Today, Switzerland generates roughly 60% of its energy demand from hydroelectric plants, and another 35% from nuclear. That's right, kids. Switzerland built renewables before it was cool. Internationally, politics had taken a rather strange turn at this point. Europe had at last decided that setting itself ablaze wasn't nearly as much fun as it used to be, and it decided to try out a newer, cooler style of warfare. And here, we come to one of the strange contradictions of the era. Switzerland has always been neutral, but that was to avoid conflicts with France, Italy, Germany, and Austria. What happens now when all four of those nations, fully surrounding you, are all on the same side against the foreign adversary? Does this at last lend itself to taking a side? Well, at least according to Switzerland, the answer is still no. Throughout the course of the conflict, Switzerland had to make a continued show to the Soviets and Eastern Bloc that, although the state was fully surrounded by the West, its position was officially neutral. The Soviet Union, for its part, did everything it could to change that neutral sentiment. The Hungarian Uprising of 1956 and Czechoslovak Uprising of 1968 both served to inflame the Swiss populace, who watched their neighbors be brutally suppressed by Eastern forces. Switzerland would serve as a primary location for refugees from both conflicts, which only further turned opinion against the Reds. All of this also helped to slowly erode the socialist movement in Switzerland, which slowly descended in party ranking. In addition to the diplomatic games, Switzerland also played the military game. This mostly meant the expansion of the Swiss defensive network, constructing ever more elaborate systems in case of invasion. This included two novel steps: mandatory service in the army for well-bodied males, and the addition of a nuclear shelter to all buildings in construction. The result is both one of the largest reserve army forces in the world, and also the only nation on Earth that has the shelter capacity for its entire population. But far from just being defensive, the Swiss military took offensive positions too. It is often forgotten, but Switzerland had a thriving nuclear arms program, and although they never managed to construct any nuclear bombs, this was more attributable to budget constraints and political objection than scientific prowess and nuclear resources. Switzerland purchased 10 tons of uranium from the Belgian Congo, which it would slowly enrich, and received aid from the French nuclear program in the establishment of its own. In the end, the program lost support. Most of these resources would be diverted to the aforementioned nuclear energy sector. The Swiss nuclear program was slowly turned into a council on nuclear issues, which would, in turn, be dissolved in 1988. As of today, Switzerland possesses no nuclear weapons. While internationally, Switzerland maintained its cold, neutral approach, the internal system was warming up. As the socialists lost their control, a variety of new parties entered the stage. In 1958, the socialists claimed only 2 seats out of 7 on the Federal Council, and were now joined by 2 members of the Christian Democratic People's Party, a center-to-center-right party, 2 members of the Free Democratic Party, a center-right party, and 1 of what would become the Swiss People's Party, a far-right group. This coalition, which would in time become characterized by compromise, became known as the Magic Formula, and proved effective enough at running the Swiss state that this distribution of seats would last all the way from 1958 to 2003, when the Swiss People's Party, the far-right end, would pick up an additional seat from the Free Democratic Party, and, over the course of a controversy-strewn term in office, tear down much of the compromise system that had existed previously. Despite the progressive nature of some of Switzerland's reforms regarding workers' rights, it would not be up until 1971 that women would gain the right to vote on a federal level. Even after that point, it would not be until 1990 that the last of the cantons granted women the right to vote on the cantonal level. Many see this as a sign of the defects of such a slow political system, and has been the source of much controversy ever since. Elsewhere in Switzerland, a different right was being fought over. You may recall several episodes back when the Canton of Bern annexed the former bishopric of Basel. From 1945, it became increasingly apparent that this territory was not all too keen to just be a chunk of Bern, and began agitating for independence. Military separatists began rising up and conducted what can only be described as a terrorist program reminiscent of the IRA. On the 23rd of June, 1974, a cantonal poll was held, resulting in the decision to form a new canton of Jura. In a second poll, on 16th of March, 1975, 3 districts opted to secede, while the remaining 4 voted in favor of remaining with Bern. In 1977, the population of what was going to be the new canton ratified the cantonal constitution. Finally, the population of Switzerland, in a national referendum, accepted the accession of the new canton to the Swiss Confederacy with an 82.3% majority, and the new canton was officially created on the 1st of January, 1979. With the creation of the Canton of Jura, militant activism declined, but there remained a politically active irredentist movement in the Bernese Jura. In particular, the municipality of Vellerat found itself in the Canton of Bern, but it could only be reached via roads from the Canton of Jura. Vellerat proclaimed itself a free municipality and campaigned to join the new canton, which it eventually did in 1996. To this day, the conflict remains a touchy subject for many, as people on both sides wish to redraw the borders. The nation has also come off of its 30-year economic high, with a series of bankruptcies and mergers in the 90s, mostly as a result of globalization, cutting hard into the state, especially in the French-speaking half of the country. Since then, the state has recovered and now sits as the 20th largest economy in the world, especially impressive given its size. Still, it is not the unbreakable system it once was. As the Cold War began winding down, Switzerland emerged into a new political climate, one characterized not so much by the actions of individual players as big multinational organizations. Chief among these was the UN, which, despite having its European headquarters located in Geneva, Switzerland was not a member of. In 1986, an attempt to join was firmly struck down by the populace, and while the state did join in 2002, the margin of victory was only one canton. Since then, however, Switzerland has established itself as a valuable mediator in such organizations, and the domestic popularity of the institution has risen. But joining the UN was easy in comparison to the big one, the EU. A vote in 1992 to join the EEA, a sort of EU light that today includes Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein, was rejected by the slimmest of majorities, 50.3%. After that, several further referendums on beginning the process of EU membership have been rejected. But despite that, the nation has moved toward further integration, including a variety of economic treaties, and perhaps most notable of all, membership in the Schengen zone, which allows free movement between all EU countries without the need for a passport. This has come under increasing pressure as new waves of immigration from the Middle East have increased anti-movement groups. But for now at least, the population is in support of such an agreement. Of all the things discussed today, I think EU membership is the biggest thing currently on the horizon for the Swiss state. But what that outcome will be remains to be seen. And that's it. That's Switzerland, at least as far as this podcast is concerned. But don't go yet, because there's still more to talk about. My goal with all of these series is, on some level, to figure out what the point of all of this was. And that's what I want to tackle now. To get a little bit more specific, the question we want to ask ourselves regarding Switzerland is, how exactly a multilingual and multicultural state at the crossroads of all of the great empires of Western Europe managed to not only survive, but thrive, and, over time, establish itself as one of the wealthiest states in the world, despite possessing no natural resources? And, in general, there are a few common answers. The first we should talk about is also the one most cited, and for good reason, geography. It is an enticing solution. The Swiss state was able to survive because its mountainous terrain forced the disparate ethnic groups to cooperate while providing defense against foreign invaders. And don't get me wrong, I think there is a lot of truth to this answer, but I think it gets a little bit too much credit. The first aspect, defensibility, is really just an anachronism. Such claims about defensibility ignore the fact that the state was successfully invaded during the French Revolution, and that really at any point during the 19th century, any of their neighbors could have carved them up. They ignore the fact that during the conflicts with the Habsburgs in the medieval age, armies were small enough that mountain passes were large enough for regular conflict, and that since most conflicts were fought on Swiss territory, the advantage is more attributable to the classic home field advantage. The second claim is that the terrain forced ethnic groups to cooperate. And this is true in some respects. Especially at the outset, among the German cantons, this really does do a good job of explaining how they were held together. But it loses its strength the further forward in time we go, because eventually the Swiss start expanding into territory that, rather than draw them together, should hold them apart. The Italian Alpine regions they conquered were as separated from Bern as they were from Milan. Geneva is much more naturally drawn toward Paris than Zurich. It ignores the fact that up until the 19th century, most Swiss were very content to think about themselves as citizens of separate cantons and not as a single nation. Around the fringes, it is the opposite that occurs. Rather than draw them together, it divides them from each other. Thus, we must keep looking. The second answer is not very common in relation to Switzerland, but it is common in relation to other nations, and that is the idea of a nationalist fiction. The concept of a historical society or story that can be used as a basis for the existence of a modern state. But this doesn't really work either. It's not for lack of trying, but more that its fictions are not particularly robust. The main one employed by the state is the Helvetians, who longtime listeners will remember as a Gallic tribe conquered by Julius Caesar. But that tribe didn't last, and so no matter how many times the Swiss attach Helvetica to their institutions, the story doesn't draw them together. The third answer is where things start getting interesting, in large part because it is unique to the Swiss state, and that is neutrality. The line of logic goes that by ensuring it avoided international conflict, all the state had to do was to hold everything together and keep domestic woes at bay. And I will argue the case that this, more than anything else, is why the state held itself together. Rather than be torn apart by foreign adversaries, it kept itself separate and defended. It also quite cleanly explains how the state came to thrive. Rather than burning itself down every generation or so, the state could continually push forward economically and socially. The only problem with choosing neutrality as our answer to the grand question of how did Switzerland both survive and thrive is that now we have to answer a different question. How did Switzerland stay neutral? It is here that geography starts becoming the correct answer, even if not for obvious reasons. Going back all the way to the medieval ages, the Alpine geography provided the state with three things. First, separation from German, French, or Italian cultural powers, which made control costly or ineffective. Second, control over the mountain passes, which, as they could not be effectively policed by forces on either end, provided a decent stream of wealth. And third, it created good soldiers. The first and third, soldiers and cultural separation, gave Switzerland the ability to militarily stand independent, and the second and third gave the economic ability. From there, neutrality came as a result of two things. The first was the tradition among the greater powers to maintain neutrality, at first due to the mercenaries Switzerland supplied, and, as time went on, because they had always done it. The second was very active diplomatic channels abroad, constantly maintaining not a passive neutrality, but an active one. And over time, this neutrality allowed Switzerland to create its own resources, not iron and coal, but reliability and stability. And those could be sold very profitably to the world. This, in the end, is my grand thesis, that Switzerland survived on a neutrality secured by its geography. You can, of course, disagree with this, but I think this is the best understanding of how the Swiss state was able to achieve what it did. And if I'm right, that only leaves one problem left. If the solution really is so embedded in geography, neutrality, and tradition, this really isn't a model that can be exported. In the end, Switzerland is a success story that will not be repeated elsewhere. It stands alone. Join me in 2 weeks for a special one-off episode. Until then, share the show, rate the show, subscribe to the show, send me emails at historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com. And until next time, was Ignanya, ciao, and goodbye.